You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.
Hello, welcome to the Daily Nationalist. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson returning after 2 weeks off, and this is being recorded in the evening of the 18th of December, 2024. And as always, when I go away for any length of time or have some kind of a leave of absence, something crazy happens. And this time around, it was the fall of Bashar al-Assad in Syria. And many of you know that the Syrian case has been a concern of mine since college, when I first began work on Hafez al-Assad's government in Syria and the rule of the Ba'ath Party. Overthrowing Assad, of course, primarily was done for the sake of a greater Israel, and to open up yet another front for the Russian government. I wrote back in 2015, of course, this has already been going on for a while, I was the very first to mention that the Free Syrian Army, or ISIS, Al-Qaeda, that these are Western-created and maintained institutions. And at that time, early September 2015, I wrote that the Russian brokered peace deal would isolate Turkey and Israel, not to mention exposing the West's financing of ISIS. But none of this, and I said this at the time, none of that restored the shattered infrastructure, whether it be in Syria or Libya or Iraq, or reverse the brain drain or bring back to life those unnecessarily killed here. Keep in mind throughout, I've been following this and talking about this and writing about this for many years, and certainly with great severity since this all began a decade ago. I also wrote back then that Assad has always been willing to talk, which is something that the U.S. had always rejected. It's nothing to do with. Diplomatic solutions are out of the question where Israel's security is concerned, or where attacking Russia is concerned. I noted at the time that several things stood in the way of talks among the various factions with the legitimate Syrian government, which was the Ba'ath Party. The first thing that's in the way is that the fighters for these so-called rebel groups are non-Syrian. They're mercenaries financed by Israel or the U.S. from all over the world, as far away as as Western China, because there's Uyghurs there. That movement is a part of this. It's all, the various factions of American interests abroad. The second reason is the U.S. was not willing to stay on the sidelines. The U.S. has demanded full control over the process from day one, again, for Israel's sake. Syria is not a major oil producer. This rarely has anything to do with oil, although the pipeline I did mention years ago. The third thing is that the U.S. government says that no deal is acceptable that doesn't involve the removal of Assad and the Ba'ath Party. Like in Iraq, it's not just the fall of Assad, but the U.S. now, with a certain level of control over Syria, will de-Ba'athize the government. So then supporters of Assad will be purged in increasingly violent ways. The fourth reason that talks were out of the question was that Assad himself said, especially in the case of contested cities like Aleppo, Turkey was so deeply involved in financing these militias that any negotiations would reveal pretty quickly that this is not a Syrian movement at all. And of course, the media is corrupt and clueless as always. In March of 2015, Assad released 600 POWs as a gesture of goodwill. But there was no reciprocation whatsoever. Now, one of the things that Putin did early on was to expose the American financing and maintenance of ISIS and all of these different groups. But now we're talking about the completion of the so-called dirty war that the U.S. and the Israelis waged in Syria. His replacement is this hack, is Mohammed al-Julani, who of course was very closely connected with al-Qaeda, part of the and the ISIS organization al-Baghdadi. But changing al-Nusra's name to Jabhat Fateh al-Sham and then Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, purposely to obscure the links with al-Qaeda, but no one bought it. But I'm not sure even why rebranding was necessary. Kyle Anzalone wrote on the 13th about this rebranding process, but they weren't doing this a decade ago. And as most of you know by now, that Jolani had a $10 million bounty on him for at least being captured alive. But Jolani is not a stranger to any of this. Of course, he's been financed by the U.S. and the Israelis for a long time and has been protected by the Turks, which have been very disappointing. You know, I was initially shocked by this development, and until I thought about it for a few minutes, that war has been waged constantly on Syria's economy since the initial war died down a few years ago. Of course, both Israel and Turkey attacking different parts of the country, and Israel just pounding what they say are almost 75% of Syria's military assets, where, you know, the Syrian budget had been reduced to almost nothing. And being a soldier in the Syrian Arab Army was not exactly a rewarding job, and simply no money existed. Of course, he was the, you know, military governor of Idlib province, and that's where these groups have their origin for the most part. The Russians put ISIS on the sidelines, and that was the only reason that you had a freezing of that war, and it even left the front page for a while. And it's no surprise to anybody that the Kurdish, you know, they've carved out their own place, have been on the American payroll for a very long time, from Saddam Hussein's era. And the U.S., of course, is in the eastern quarter, destroying what there was of the most valuable resources of Damascus, the potential for their own economic growth. And the Kurdish region that's been kind of carved out shows these people ruling over Arabs who they absolutely despise. And we know this through the Al-Hol camp, which is a very nasty prison. And but the Kurdish movement, who uses child soldiers as young as 15, there have been protests against this from other Kurds, has been a Washington project for a very long time. But even once that war, the so-called civil war, was over, there was no chance of rebuilding its infrastructure. As I've said 100 times, these wars aren't really military matters. They're economic ones. The point is to keep these successful leaders, Saddam Hussein, the Iranian mullahs, Gaddafi, even Bashar in Sudan years ago, from building a successful economy on nationalist and national socialist foundations. And that's really what the Ba'ath Party was. And the U.S., of course, is also not just destroying military targets, but civilian targets as well. As I also wrote about many years ago. So within a space of 3 weeks, maybe, the conflict, which kind of was forgotten about given the rest of the warfare in Israel and the war in Ukraine, and it was almost the exact same time, and Anzalone and some others say the same thing, that once the truce in Lebanon was announced, Jalani advanced, taking the city of Aleppo, aided by advanced drones, no doubt from the West, and the increasingly impoverished Syrian army was quickly defeated. Many of you have heard some of the ridiculous statements this idiot named Josh Rogan saying that the people have liberated themselves from tyranny. Max Boot, who writes for the Post, that Syria is free at last. Bill Kristol, of course, said the same thing. And the level of ignorance you have to make statements like this, where had this war not occurred, more than a decade ago now, Syria would be a fairly well-developed country. And the same thing goes for Iraq and even more so for Libya. To secure the greater Israel is the purpose. To attack Russia is a very close secondary purpose. And of course, Tehran and Hezbollah, a tertiary purpose, very close. And this is really good for nobody but the Zionist establishment in Israel, trying to separate Hezbollah from Tehran. I mean, physically and geographically separated. Syria was such a key player. And this war, just like in, you know, if you remember what I said about Libya, this war there has only just begun. And that's the point. Peace was never the purpose. It's to reduce the economic potential of the country to nothing. There's a deliberate policy of starved and starvation and impoverishment by the U.S. Years ago, I detailed the deliberate American helicopter attacks on wheat fields. The country was food insecure for a very long time, and that goes for the army as well as anyone else. The militias, of course, being fed from the outside. Now, I do want to note, and this was on the 14th of December. I think he's from the Philippines. His name is Raul Pepa. He doesn't, I don't know if he still thinks this, but he doesn't count Assad out. His speech, I don't know if you've read Assad's speech upon leaving Damascus. He didn't say a lot, except to say that he did this only from advice and necessity. But Pepa argues that this departure of Assad and his forces from Damascus is more of a calculated maneuver than a complete exhaustion and collapse of his state. That this is not a surrender. He argues that the retreat reflects a strategy to, in a later date, take control over Syria. The Syrian army still controls a chunk of territory in the extreme eastern part of Syria. But, you know, none of this would have happened without outside finance. The way to engage in counterinsurgency, given the number of militia having to spread the army out all over the place, and fighting enemies that are extremely well armed and well trained. ISIS came from out of nowhere, if you remember, and having to fragment his forces would deplete Damascus's manpower and, of course, resources. And this was sort of, according to him anyway, a way of stepping back and consolidating. Loyalist forces, as he calls them, can rearm, can reorganize, and prepare for the future. So he's saying that this isn't really the end. I'm not entirely convinced. The only piece of information, of course, is that Assad went to Russia, where Gaddafi Saddam Hussein wouldn't leave and were captured by their enemies. Both were murdered. There's no such thing as a court for these guys, so it doesn't make any difference. They were both murdered. Now, Pepa claims that the U.S., was driven out of Afghanistan, but he calls it a diminished commitment after decades of involvement. Maybe this is relevant, that the Islamist government supported by the Zionists could soon be abandoned. Of course, that implies that the government would be able to function at all. It's more likely that a Libyan situation is developing. But the West may, as time goes on, especially with the complete defeat of Ukraine, or Kiev, the fact that the IDF is massively bogged down, has not defeated Hamas, is at its, stretched to its breaking point, that the West's resources are not going to stay in Syria. Pepa claims that Assad's forces are buying time. The economic war waged on Syria was, of course, inhuman. Syria never threatened the U.S., actually never threatened anyone. But given the ideology, given his unified rule over a country that was increasing in terms of prosperity and economic growth prior to a decade ago, that once the militias start fighting each other, that this is when Assad's government can reassert itself. The foundation of these militias are very precarious. Not one of them, over all the others, is capable of functioning. So he's arguing that shifts in global priorities are going to allow for a resurgence of the Ba'ath Party. And he says that Assad's retreat should not be mistaken for resignation. Instead, it's a calculated response. Now, there is a certain consolidation of the SAA, or Syrian Arab Army, outside of Syria's borders, show a certain level of intent, given the fact that, very much like in Sudan or in Libya, that Afghanistan may be a certain example. The Taliban were driven out of Kabul only later on to reform, regroup, resupply, and take the country back. Places like Sudan and Libya, you never had a functional state whatsoever. The only real functional state is the legitimate one, that is of the Ba'ath Party of Bashar al-Assad. So the argument that this may be a strategic pause, that there is a movement to consolidate outside of the country, it's very possible. I'm not necessarily endorsing it, but as the external backers of these Islamic movements start focusing elsewhere, especially given the situation in Israel. So he's trying to make the argument that this isn't the catastrophe that the regime's press is presenting. Anyway, as is so often the case, I like to go to Mike Whitney, who, at least from a strictly military point of view, is one of my go-to guys on this. And this is as of a couple of days ago. But he reduces the situation on the ground to, given the landmass of Syria, to five groups. The first is, the HTS, we might as well just call them Al-Qaeda. It's nothing new. Pretty much everyone knows the U.S. has been financing them, that they've been a part of the war from the very beginning, and hence had nothing to do with 9/11. And I think is the logical conclusion. The small Kurdish enclave, the so-called SDF, the leadership of the Kurds are educated in America and are leftists and feminists in their, at least in their public pronouncements. Of course, the Israel Defense Forces, the Turks near their border, and finally, the remnants of the Syrian Arab Army. And as we all know, things can change, but I think the previous author we talked about is correct in that there's not one faction that has the capacity to emerge that can stitch together this viable Syrian state. That simply isn't going to happen. One of the reasons I do have some optimism for the remnants of the Syrian Arab army in the Far East is that they are not going to surrender. They know what's going to happen to them. And the same thing goes for, you know, some of these Ba'ath Party operatives in the cities stretching out an olive branch. I mean, this is simply self-preservation. Although I don't want to, the economic and military aspects of this are very clear. But, for example, many years ago, Saddam Hussein, his army fell largely from bribery. So it's not just that Assad has left, whether it's tactical or whether it's the end, isn't relevant, because it's not just him. The entire Syrian state, as Whitney said, is gone. As a functional government, it doesn't exist. It's not like someone new can simply take over an existing bureaucracy. The state is gone. And that's been, you know, when Assad left, he said that, you know, it would be better. I mean, I'm obviously paraphrasing, but he said it would be better if these militias would take over what I've created. But they don't have this capacity. These are guerrilla fighters. They're not politicians. I mean, Jolani's nonsense, yes, but how much of what the media is saying about this is just utter nonsense? I know they're making up stories right and left, so I don't want to be too pessimistic. But this has been going on for such a long time. He cites the very famous document called The Strategy for Israel in the 1980s. Many of you know exactly what I'm talking about. It was written in 1982 by a very famous Zionist intellectual named Oded Yinon. And it came as the detailed plan for the Middle East. And I just want to cite something. I think I've cited this before. Quote something directly from it. He says, and this is Yinon's own words back in 82. He said, "The Muslim Arab world is built like a temporary house of cards put together by foreigners without the wishes and desires of the inhabitants having been taken into account. Every Arab Muslim state nowadays faces ethnic social destruction from within, and in some, a civil war is already starting. All the Arab states east of Israel are torn apart, broken up, and riddled with conflict. The national ethnic minority picture extending from Morocco to India and from Somalia to Turkey points to the absence of stability and a rapid degeneration in the entire region. When this picture is added to the economic one, we see how the entire region is built like a house of cards, unable to withstand severe problems." Well, one of the issues there, and again, given the year that this was written, the Ba'athist state in Syria was only a few years old. And the Ba'athist, the social nationalist movement, a secular, you know, pro-Christian state, like in Damascus or in Baghdad, either didn't exist yet or was just getting started. But Yinon also goes so far as to say that, Lebanon is an example. It's five provinces, it's dissolution. This is the precedent for the entire Arab world, as he says. But I bring up the fact that the Ba'ath movement was fairly new when this was written, was that they had the solution. That a single party with many factions, with a semi-planned economy, was the only way out of both preserving state and economic sovereignty at the same time. And if you abstract these governments from the wars that were imposed on them, Syria included, you had fairly successful governments. Saddam Hussein had the exact same set up as Gaddafi did in terms of using the oil money for internal development, something that, you know, in the West would be unthinkable. But he doesn't mention that too much, but he does use the Lebanese example in 1982. That was very well known as what he wants and what Israel wants for the entire Middle East. So endless guerrilla war amongst irregular forces, all financed by the same group of people, that's not a problem, that's the goal. Inciting ethnic and religious violence against or among groups within any given society, that's the point. That's the purpose of it. It defangs any militarist movement. It defangs any chance of economic development. That's the nature of what Israeli security is all about. Yunon then concludes by saying that genuine coexistence and peace will reign over the land. And by that, I think he means just the entire Middle East. Only when the Arabs understand that without Jewish rule between the Jordan and the sea, they'll have neither existence nor security. A nation of their own and security will be theirs only in Jordan. So the fact that this is written so long ago, it means that everything, I mean, this is official policy. This is adopted as the official policy, especially amongst the Likudites. There was never any attempt at peace, land for peace, or any of these other formulas that the media created in terms of their obligations on the UN Resolution 242, evacuating the occupied territories. But, you know, this is nothing new, or at a very minimum, back in 96 when Netanyahu came to office as prime minister, the war had been going on against Syria for a long time. But 2011, 2012 is when it began in earnest, where it was Obama who had the CIA overthrow the Syrian government, attempt to overthrow the Syrian government was called Operation Timber Sycamore. But the rapidity of the fall of Assad, or the retreat of Assad, shouldn't be as shocking as it may have been at first, and it was that way to me. We're talking about more than a decade of brutal economic sanctions. A low-level war that drained the economy. The American occupation of what there was of Syrian oil and its transport capacity. And the Israeli attacks on it consistently. There's been a consistent attack on Syria from the Zionist movement and hence the U.S. from throughout this entire period of time. The Israeli hatred of Assad, the Assad family and the Ba'ath Party, knew no bounds. For Netanyahu coming into office, this is when they adopted the so-called clean break strategy back in 96, to reject any kind of peace. The notion that they would, you know, withdraw from occupied lands in return for peace, that was completely rejected, although it wasn't said openly at the time. But taking Syria, taking out the Ba'athist government was an essential part of it. The U.S. has now either led or sponsored wars. In Iraq, if we go back to 1990, the invasion was in 2003, but it was just essentially one long, unified military operation. Of course, you know, Lebanon, Libya in 2011, the CIA operation in Syria, the Sudan, as I've mentioned many times here in the past, even backing the Ethiopian invasion in Somalia in 2006, you know, and of course there's one pawn standing, and that's Iran. But if you remember, you know, how Turkey seems to operate here, Turkey and Iran have pretty good relations. They have an enemy in common in terms of the Kurds. But the Turkish government has always gone back and forth. They're very unpredictable. But now, the next target is the Iranian. There are all these places where these wars, Libya, Sudan, Somalia, Lebanon, Syria, Palestine, with Iran now being completely surrounded and no longer with its Syrian ally, you're talking about millions of deaths and the complete destruction of any chance of any economic development. Now, this Mohammed al-Bashir, Syria's interim prime minister, again, who's been at Idlib, as I mentioned already, the alleged job they seem to have is to make sure that the bureaucracy that does not exist continues to function. This is just on paper, of course. Al-Bashir speaks fluent English, which shouldn't surprise anybody. And he's going to, as far, given past experience, what he's going to do is just oversee a pure austerity regime, even worse, than the Syrian government was forced to have. So, but in no way should this be taken as any kind of a unified movement. No different than the two governments in Libya represent unified anything. And Jolani, remember, and Al-Qaeda, his real name is Ahmad al-Sharaa. You know, he even trimmed his beard. I don't know if you've seen this, wearing his, you know, these westernized clothes and talking about tolerance and all these, you know, liberal slogans. It doesn't matter ultimately what his policies are. It's that the warfare continue. So, since this occurred, corporate media talking about al-Jolani as this leader of Syria, this proves the connection between al-Qaeda and ISIS, and that connection with the U.S. and the Israelis. It's just a full acceptance of what I've been saying from the very beginning. Daily Telegraph called him a moderate jihadist. You imagine being a journalist and having to write this stuff. They either simply don't know, which is more likely, or they maliciously lie. And for some reason, the magazine Rolling Stone wrote an in-depth article about him. Now, I don't know why Rolling Stone or any of these people really have the authority to do this. They're getting their information from other far more powerful sources. Rolling Stone, clearly they're trying to get a hand into pop culture to justify that with during the Cold War, of course, would never have been justified. Everything that the government did during the Cold War, if it had any negative impact on the Soviet Union, was attacked by the press. But now we have Rolling Stone talking about this moderate jihadist, and they call him a ruthlessly pragmatic, astute politician who has renounced global jihad, and he's going to unite Syria. How brilliant he is. His strategic acumen is apparent, they wrote. Now, how any of these people have the authority to write on this, it's never, the question is never asked, let alone answered. And the near worship of this guy, it's a little bit like Zelensky a few years ago. But back in 2013, some of these very same people, CNN included, were labeling him one of the world's worst terrorists. Technically, he's still on, as far as I know, still on the U.S. terrorism list today. That $10 million bounty is still active. But again, this is nothing new. You know, the rebranding may be for local opinion more than anything else. You know, the U.S. has been financing and using these movements for a very long time. I'm not sure what's so special about it now. It's just in this case, like the Iraqi case, has been going on for so long, and it happened so quickly, given the situation both in Ukraine and Lebanon and the Gaza Strip. But Jolani claims to want to compromise with all of these other factions. And of course, as I said at the beginning, he's not going to take over either. Bashir or any of these other people are not going to take over anything, since it not only does it not exist in terms of bureaucracy and banks and everything else. Not only does it not exist anymore, but these fighters from al-Nusra, al-Qaeda, and ISIS, from all over the world, speaking different languages and everything, they have no competence or even desire to run a country. Now, some of the more obnoxious sides of this, it shouldn't shock any of you that Jolani, the word, by the way, means al-Jolani from the Golan Heights, has, of course, as ISIS many times in the past, fully accepted the Israelis and fully accepts Zionism, that if they take over Syria and run it as a normal government, that it's not going to oppose Israel, which should be no shock to anybody. This is the final piece of the puzzle, that all of this has been financed by the U.S. and Israel, al-Qaeda and ISIS, and the conclusions coming from all of that. The IDF has taken much of southern Syria, even Mount Hermon overlooking Damascus, and that this is permanent, at least according to Netanyahu. And he says, Jolani says Syria is not ready for war and doesn't intend to go into another war. The source of concern was the Iranian militias and Hezbollah. And the danger, that danger has passed, Jolani says. This is what the regime is putting in charge of Syria. So they have no connection with any real Islamic movement, like ISIS never did. These people aren't lifting a finger to assist the situation in Lebanon or Gaza. These are Western-created militias. Israel, when he uttered that phrase, Israel was carrying out the largest air operation in its history, destroying military targets all over Syria with really no response. And the only enemies of the state, of course, for him, for Jolani, is Iran. Saying exactly what ISIS has always said and what it's always been. So the factions that have been installed, and they have been installed, are all pro-Israel. Even the Free Syrian Army, now I've been saying this from the beginning, of course, very few other people noticed. The commander of the Free Syrian Army even talked about the era of friendship and harmony with Israel. He said, "We will go for full peace with Israel. Since the outbreak of the Syrian civil war, we have never made any critical comments against Israel, unlike Hezbollah, who stated they aim to liberate Jerusalem and the Golan Heights. That Israel will plant a rose in the Syrian garden." He even went so far as to ask for Israeli support in forming a new government. These factions within al-Qaeda have said that Israel, you know, is an ally, not an enemy. "We're quite happy," one of them said, when you attacked Hezbollah. "Very happy, and that you won, you've defeated them," which I'm not convinced of quite yet. But this just proves in the most blatant and clumsy form that Israel is behind all of this. That they've been training the so-called Syrian opposition of foreigners in Jordan from its very inception, whether it be al-Qaeda or ISIS or any of it. So this ends any debate. Not that I'm going to get any apology from the thousands of people who attacked me for this. If you remember, right on this program, I think it was 2016, ISIS fighters fired an Israeli position in the Golan Heights, but immediately apologized, thinking that, you know, they said that we thought that you were Syrian government forces. So it really doesn't matter as far as Washington, D.C. is concerned, or New York is concerned. Changing the names, it doesn't matter. The average American doesn't know anything. The only thing that the economic elites care about, or the regime cares about, is what they can get out of this, even, you know, militarily, and that Israel doesn't have to worry about it anymore. Millions of people are sent into poverty that never would have before. And possibly, you know, taking whatever resources are available. But all these writers are talking about their concerns with, oh, we can't be publicly supporting al-Qaeda and ISIS. Well, that hasn't been of interest in a very long time. And dumb Americans, especially these Republicans, still believe that there is this, you know, this war on ISIS or al-Qaeda. It destroys the entire 9/11 narrative, since there was never a time when the al-Qaeda affiliates were not under at least U.S. financial control. And the U.S. was assisting ISIS back in September of 2016. The U.S. fought alongside ISIS, taking control of Deir Zor, the oil-producing capital of Syria. The U.S. bombed Syria's army in that area so that the surrounding ISIS forces could rush and take control. And the same thing for, you know, U.S. bombed the city of Mosul in Iraq. U.S. and Turkey provided a protected pathway for surviving jihadists from ISIS to travel to Syria for this very same operation. There's, you know, this is nothing new here. But none of these writers seem to have any conception of what's going on around them, either because they simply don't know. This is part of what happens when you have no access to people like me. And when this stuff finally becomes common knowledge, they're not going to say, "Wow, that guy was right all along." Whoever has a microphone and a major network at the time is going to be credited for this. I know they listen to our stuff. I know they listen to people like me. because I've been saying this long before these people are getting all breathless about it. And all these Jews like Jeffrey Sachs condemning Israel, you know, where were they back in 2006? All these people attacking Netanyahu simply as a matter of strategy and nothing else. Where were they at the time? Of course, they were nowhere to be found because everything is a matter of fraud and show and deception. Anyway, thank you everyone for listening. I'll talk to you next week. Bye-bye.
You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.